Welcome to the For Love and Money podcast, the show where business and social purpose meet to inspire a movement for positive change. Here's your host, Carolyn Butler Madden.
My guest today is Sasha Tichkovsky. She's the co-founder and CEO of Koskala, Australia's leading sustainability practitioner in the furniture and design industry. Sasha has become an influential voice for circular business and social impact as she transforms Koskala towards total circularity by 2027 and absolute zero emissions by 2035. She leads programs also that use design skills to support Australia's Indigenous communities. Now, Sasha founded Koskala in 2000 with her partner, Russell Koskala. They both left behind lucrative jobs in the corporate sector in a bid to create a company with a courageous mindset and strong social conscience. Today, they work with some of the world's leading corporations and educational institutions to create work and learning spaces of the future. This includes organisations like Airbnb, Pinterest, Apple, Google, and some of Australia's leading law firms and banks. In 2017, Koskala became Australia's first certified furniture B Corporation. Sasha is committed to manufacturing Koskala's range in Australia, and she's a fearless advocate for using design skills to affect social change. Now, our interview covers Sasha's career journey leading to why and how Koskala started 24 years ago, and she shares the story of its evolution from a business that started with the principles of designing furniture that was affordable and sourced and manufactured locally, to their commitment today to achieve total circularity by 2027. It's a story of innovation and leadership, and one that I'm certain will provide inspiration and insight to others who want to understand how business can solve some of society's most challenging problems. Sasha, welcome to the For Love and Money podcast.
Thanks very much for having me.
So first up, I'd like to ask you, Sasha, in your view, does love have a role to play in business?
I definitely think it does. So I think it's probably the emotion that kind of drives our passion and connects us to people and to the work that you're doing. So when we first started Koskala, we had a company motto, which we still kind of have today, which is follow your heart, trust your judgment, do it with joy. And I think that absolutely kind of fairly and squarely set out that, you know, love was part of it, that you had to love what you were doing. It didn't necessarily mean, it doesn't mean that you love every single day and every single task that you do, but the overarching feeling that you get from working on something or working here, I guess what we want is that people actually really love what we're about and that it matters to them.
That's it, isn't it? That it matters. I love that. Follow your heart, trust your judgment, do it with joy. And as you say, it's not, there's stuff you do that you don't like doing. It's not, you know, roses and fairy dust all along the way, but it's that, but it's that greater love, isn't it? That keeps you awake at night sometimes, and that you wake up in the morning thinking, how do I do this? It's deeper and it's intense and it's joyful.
And I think it's about sort of, I think it helps you to look at problems as something to solve rather than something that's insurmountable or a disaster, or, you know, because you realize that it's just part of kind of getting to the end game. So
and that's it. Absolutely. It gives you a different mindset. Absolutely nailed that one. Thank you. So can you share with our listeners, we're going to go deep into your journey and what Koskala is and what you're doing, but first of all, just give us a brief overview. What is Koskala and what purpose does it serve?
So Koskala is an Australian furniture solutions company that provides furniture solutions for workplaces, learning environments, so schools and unis, and also residential homes. We have been in business. This is our 24th year of being in business.
Congratulations.
Thanks. From the outset, we had an ambition of manufacturing all of our products in Australia, and we still do that today. So all of our products are original designs that are made to our specifications. We work with sort of leading Australian corporates, almost every uni around Australia, and a lot of wonderful residential clients who we're lucky enough to have our products in their homes. I guess like one of the things that's probably differentiated us from the beginning was one, that focus on local manufacturing. So, and two, our social impact goals and commitments. So we have fairly high ambitions in relation to impact. So we definitely see ourselves as being change agents and at the forefront of change. Within an industry that's fairly conservative, I think. And the two sort of impact areas that we focus on are reconciliation with our First Nations community members, and then also in terms of environment. So really trying to push the envelope, reduce our impact as much as possible, which I think as a product-based business is a real challenge.
Yeah, and we're going to get deeper into what you've been doing, but I'd love you first to share a little bit of your own personal background journey that brought you to where you are today.
Yeah, I definitely didn't start out, you know, working in design. So when I was a kid, like I've always kind of been motivated by impact. And when I was younger, I really wanted to be a doctor and go and work for Médecins Sans Frontières. I sort of had a fairly very kind of strong-willed mother, a German mother who had a role that each of her five children would play in life and had their careers mapped out for them. And she decided that I should become a lawyer instead. And so I went and studied economics first and then did my law degree. I did my law degree at night while I was working for one of the really big law firms in Australia. And that was a really interesting experience. It was really full on. We worked crazy hours. It was kind of that typical, what was a typical kind of Gen X workplace in your first role, where you just did everything for work and you partied hard and you had fun, but you worked really, really hard. And I was studying at the same time. And I was surrounded by people who were absolutely passionate about the law, like they genuinely loved it, whereas I found it frustrating to only look at an issue from that sort of one perspective. And realised that the law definitely wasn't for me.
How far into the into it were you at that point?
I finished and was admitted as a solicitor and did all of that, but knew that that wouldn't be my long-term career. And then I got a role, a really interesting role, working at the Stock Exchange. So sort of in a cross-legal capacity initially. I worked as a deputy secretary and so had a lot of involvement in working with the CEO, went to all the board meetings, and then was really fortunate to work on a major transformation project within the exchange, which was where we listed the stock exchange on itself. So that was a big demutualization and listing, and that was fantastic. And then they asked me if I would set up and run the communications area at the stock exchange. So I sort of started as a team of one, doing all our media, investor relations, government relations, and internal comms, and then gradually built a little team of specialists, I guess. And then met Russell.
Who is your current business? Who's your business partner?
And partner in life. So,
okay, right. Yeah.
So we initially started off as, partners before we started the business, but actually it wasn't long after we met that we started the business. So he came from an interior design background with an absolute love of furniture, and we went on a big long holiday, which was sort of probably the first real break I'd had since school, And I remember sitting in a little cafe in Paris, and we were like, okay, what are we going to do when we come back? I knew I was going to leave. I'd had sort of other approaches from corporates to go and work for them. And he said, what about if we started a furniture business? I was like, okay. That wasn't really in my kind of, in my sort of plan, but I'm happy to have a look at it. And when we came back to Australia, it was really interesting for me to see that there was almost no local product. So basically no real local brands. There was only one that was going quite well called Norman and Quain. So they were sort of the real pioneers. There was also not much for people like us. So where we were kind of youngish professionals who had a bit of disposable income, who liked design, but didn't have, crazy budgets to go out and spend tens of thousands of dollars on imported sofas. And we wanted something better than IKEA and Freedom. And so in a way that was kind of where we started, but we also had the benefit of him having worked on some incredible kind of workplace projects and other interior design projects. So sort of had a bit of an idea of what the industry needed and what they were looking for in that regard. And then it sort of grew from there. So we had a really amazing launch party.
So this was 2000, right?
This was just probably just before 2000, but roughly 2000. And we got some press from that and it just kind of grew from there. And then I left the stock exchange and started consulting with an issues management company. And that was really interesting too, because I got to dip in and out of different companies and sort of understand what made them unique.
Yeah.
How different organizations operated. And the other thing actually I forgot to say was when we went on our holiday, Russell actually had organized for us to go to a number of different furniture manufacturers through Europe.
He already had the idea in his head.
Where he had contacts because he'd done a lot of specification of their work. But what was really interesting for me was getting an insight into all these different businesses, because we went from sort of one factory in Italy where it was a big, typical kind of manufacturing facility. It had a hooter that went off to tell everyone it was lunchtime, and then everyone would go into the cafeteria and eat their pasta and then wander kind of back out to the floor. And then they'd be smoking on the floor, finishing their card games while the next hooter went off to tell everyone it was time to get back to work. And then we went to another factory, which was an amazing lighting company in Antwerp. That was, super high tech, really totally different kind of workplace, beautiful building where they had the whole building. One level was just dedicated to accommodation. And they worked with three different Belgian designers whose only brief was to utilize their lighting products as best as they could, but they had free rein. And then we went to another factory where on the one side, the guys were doing all these beautiful, like, hand finishing of products, hand stitching them. And then on the other side, they had fully roboticized this manufacturing line. So it could work 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, didn't need lights. It just basically could operate almost virtually itself.
Wow.
So that was kind of really interesting, even within the furniture world, sort of getting that insight. And I think that's...
So it wasn't really a holiday, was it?
Yeah, well, at one point I was like, hang on, this is enough. So luckily we had a bit of time in Thailand to do our diet certificate before we came home. yeah.
Very smart, though. It's like, doing it under the holiday.
Yes.
Idea. Yeah.
We did go to Lapland, so that was pretty cool.
Oh, beautiful.
Well. that was sort of our journey my journey, I guess, in getting to where we are. And then after about 18 months of consulting, it was kind of obvious that we wouldn't be able to grow the business beyond where it was unless, we were both kind of really put our heart and soul into it. and time. And so that was where we started, and then gradually it grew from there. So we, at the same time, we both sort of started working in the business full time. We also moved to a new showroom and quadrupled our rent, kind of. So it was a big gamble. And I remember a few sleepless nights sort of thinking, oh, you know, what if this doesn't work? And then I remember, I don't know, something came back to me, and I remember someone saying, oh, you know, when you're afraid of something or you're nervous about something, think about what's your biggest fear and what's the worst outcome that could happen. And it was like, yeah, you know, what is the worst outcome? That it doesn't work and we lose our savings and go back to doing what we did, which neither of us detested. Like, we didn't hate our kind of past life. It just wasn't completely fulfilling. And so we did. And the rest is history.
I love that. And, you know, that feeling that fear and sleepless nights, I think a lot of people listening to this will be able to relate to that.
Yeah.
My experience has been, you know, the default is to run away from that kind of feeling.
Mm.
And yet it's when you do lean into it, you know, you weigh it up and you look down the barrel of the gun and yeah, understand, you know, what is the worst that can happen and weigh it up. And, you know, when you lean into that fear or discomfort, that's where your growth happens.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, whatever happens, that's where your yeah growth as a person yeah happens. So
yeah,
so good, good on you guys. So you started with your different your proposition being local, young, affordable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's sort of mid-price, which is quite a big bracket in Australia. We used a lot of solid recycled timber when we first started. So at the time we started, it was the era of kind of the minimalist white box sort of, and we felt that that wasn't necessarily reflective of the way people wanted to live, and so introduced a lot of clean line but beautiful solid recycled timber into some of our products to kind of provide a bit more warmth and texture to those spaces. And yeah, had a furniture collection and just started to try and win some projects, really.
Okay, so where Koskela is now and what you're doing with the business, talk us through that journey into the area of, you know, you start with recycled and then, you know, carbon neutral, I could see, but then you've yeah moved away from that and circular economy and in, yeah, what were the catalysts to where, how the business evolved?
Yeah. So one of the things, as I sort of came in as an outsider into the industry, one of the things that I was horrified by was the level of waste. So I don't know if you know much about like kind of how commercial office fit outs work, but generally there's a make good clause for a tenant. So if they've done any fit out works at all, they automatically have to be ripped out at the end of a tenancy. So that the new tenant can come in with a clean shell and start doing all the fit out works all over again. And that sort of generates ginormous amounts of waste. Plus with a lot of the big tenants, they can walk out of their tenancy taking their laptops and paperwork and artworks and everything else, maybe a few bits and pieces of furniture. But largely all that furniture remains in the old tenancy and it 9 times out of 10 goes into landfill.
Right.
So part of our early thinking was around trying to do things with more innovative materials and really work with manufacturing partners who were interested in experimenting with new ideas and new ways of doing stuff. And gradually kind of found some really amazing people to work with that we've worked with for, you know, like 20 odd years, which is fantastic. And then I think our focus was then really on, you know, looking at our designs, making really high quality products, kind of understanding that that was what we wanted to do from the beginning without maybe being as vocal in that, I guess. And sort of thinking about, like, when we were looking at recycled solid timber tables, it was this idea that you could pass that table down from generation to generation, and that they kind of just get better and better as they age, and they get more of a story and a history to the products. And then I think in terms of our sustainability journey, we started to get, as the pressure grew and our awareness grew around what was going on with climate change and things, you know, producing products just the same old way and thinking that it was kind of someone else's problem at the end of their life cycle just didn't seem to add up for us. We have had good Environmental Choice Australia certification for a lot of our products for a number of years. So almost our entire range is GECA certified. And we've always tried to look at, you know, what are the high VOC kind of products that are used to finish things. So really looking at all of those things and how do we create the best products for all of our different customer groups. And then I think I got to a point probably not long after we got GECA certification and when we started to explore our B Corp certification, that the sort of thinking was that, you know, yes, maybe we were doing all these good things, but how did we know how good we were? Were we really that good, or did we just think we were good? And so, and I think that was why we started to look at more certifications and different kind of environmental commitments to make and other ways to measure. And so we started to measure our carbon impact and did that for 3 years working with consultants. And we believe.
So where are you, when is this?
This would be about 4 or 5 years ago. So
okay.
We've sort of done things like we've supported Rainforest Rescue that buy back tracts of the Jane Tree and have done that since about 2009.
I love them. They've been on this podcast and they're one of my key impact partners.
Yeah, they're fantastic. So we've done sort of things like that, but, you know, never, I don't know, done things in a more concrete kind of data-driven way. And I think there is a real role to play for that sort of information in helping you make informed decisions. So then, yeah, it was about probably four or five years ago, we started to work with consultants to measure our carbon footprint. And at the time, we believed that the climate active carbon neutral certification was a really good thing, and being certified carbon neutral was beneficial. And we did that for about 3 years until I started to understand a bit more about that and what sort of, in a way, really like what carbon neutrality meant or didn't mean. And I also understand that there are a lot of caveats around that certification. So when you had gas companies that were able to get climate active carbon neutral certification, but only for their scope one or scope one and two emissions, and it just didn't seem to sort of stack up to me. And for my mind, like, certifications are really useful for customers to be able to assess different organisations and use that as a benchmark or a way to help them, because it's, you know, a little bit like all the health kind of things in food. No one has time to kind of dig down, you know, 50 different ingredient lists and look at the macros on back of packets all the time to kind of assess if one is better than the other. Or, and I think it's the same with a lot of product certifications as well. Like, I don't think there should be asterisks.
Absolutely. And just for our listeners, can you just explain a little bit more about, you know, carbon neutrality and what it means and why we need to move beyond that?
Yeah. So carbon neutrality is really where you measure your carbon emissions across all three scopes of your business. So your operations, any vehicles that you own, your power, and then also everything that you produce. And then when you're carbon neutral, it means that you buy offsets to the equivalent value, so that the theory is, and really where carbon offsets was meant to operate, is that you've done everything possible to kind of reduce your carbon footprint. And this is just offsetting that last little remainder that you can't do anything about. And unfortunately, in Australia in particular, and I'm not sure if it's the same around the world, but we really got hung up on this carbon neutrality as being like the gold standard, when actually it's just a bit of a fudge. And then there were a lot of question marks over a number of carbon offset programs around the world. So, you know, is it okay to call something a carbon offset if you say you didn't clear it? Rainforest, or do you actually need to be doing something more proactive? How do you really measure kind of the carbon that's in soil, particularly in a country like Australia, which, you know, fluctuates from extremes? And so I think we just felt like it was all a bit too fuzzy. And it was quite,
and you're still contributing to the problem. You're just trying to balance it out, aren't
correct.
You?
Correct. And, you know, there's studies that have shown that, you know, we couldn't plant anywhere near enough trees all around the world that needed to also survive to offset the amount of carbon that we're currently emitting in the atmosphere. Yeah. So, for us, I think what we decided to then do was have a look at measuring our carbon footprint, but rather than saying, okay, we're going to measure it and spend a lot of money measuring our carbon footprint, and then we're going to invest in offsets. What if we looked at other ways? Maybe they're not as quite as sophisticated ways of measuring our carbon footprint, but are there other options out there? So continue to measure our carbon emissions and to track it and to absolutely look at ways that we can minimize it. But for an organization like us that produces products, the bulk of our emissions lie in our scope 3, which is in all the products and the transport that we use to get our products to customers. And so that, to actually look at how you minimize your scope 3 emissions and how you start reducing those, requires a lot of capital investment. So requires time, R&D costs, prototyping, plus a whole lot of effort in communicating the benefits and testing and things. So what we decided to do was sort of almost create our own internal carbon budget by looking at what we'd spent on offsets, knowing what they cost sort of per ton, and then putting a dollar amount on our carbon footprint that we then use as our budget to invest in ideas that can reduce the embodied carbon in our products and in our operations and things. And I think that's
like an innovation fund.
Yeah. And I think it's a much better way to go for SMEs. I think, you know, the big end of town sort of have access to a squillions of resources and things and need to be moving faster. But for SMEs, like, we ended up using a really great tool called the SME Climate Hub as our carbon calculation tool. It may or may not be the perfect one for us going forward, but for the majority of SMEs, I think it does a really good job. It's absolutely free. It's developed sort of in partnership with the UN and Cambridge University, I think it is. And Google has sort of had a bit of a hand in working on the interface. It's easily accessible. It's endorsed. You can become part of the Race to Zero community as well. And it provides you with heaps of resources and tools and ideas for how you can reduce your carbon footprint. So I'd highly kind of recommend that tool. It's very
We'll put a link in the show notes. Is it the SME Climate Hub? You say? Okay, great.
Yeah. So that's sort of where we got to. And then really when we started to delve into our scope 3 emissions, it became sort of obvious that the best way that we could reduce those was to look at transitioning to being fully circular. And that's a really big deal when you're a product-based business. It's not a small thing to do by any means. And we've set ourselves a pretty tight deadline to do that by 2027. So it's certainly not going to be a walk in the park, and we'll definitely make mistakes along the way. But let's face it, this is our last decade. You know, if we don't do something about the state of the world, who knows?
Absolutely. And I was reading your circularity action plan for 2027, and I'd really like you to share the problem. I'll pull out one thing that I said, because we've just been talking about, you know, carbon neutrality and the problems with it and what needs to happen. And I pulled out something in the report that said the world has less than 6 years of carbon budget left to limit global warming to 1.5 degrees. We need everyone everywhere, especially businesses, to rapidly and significantly reduce the carbon we're generating and the resources we're using.
Yeah.
That's the big picture. And then if we come down to your industry and the furniture problem, can you describe the scale of the problem that we're facing here?
Yeah, the scale of the problem is huge. It's difficult to quantify as well, partly because at the moment, the way we deal with landfill in Australia, every individual council has their own ability to kind of recycle, not recycle, do what they want. And we don't have completely firm statistics on the level of waste. So because there isn't really a proper tracking system within each of those landfill sites, and even within the states, the EPAs in each state and the federal one don't really have a complete oversight. But there has been some research work done that has shown that the problem, particularly in commercial office waste, is huge. But then that's one part of it. But then think about every time you drive past a pile of furniture on the side of the road that's waiting there for a council pickup. And then you start to kind of imagine the scale of the problem and how quickly actually we transitioned from, you know, maybe our grandparents' era and even some of our parents' era, where to buy furniture was like it was a big kind of milestone in your life. And it was a big investment and you saved for it. You really considered it. Sometimes you bought it on lay-by or some kind of a, you know, an idea like that. And then you always thought that you would keep it for, you know, 20, 30 years. Maybe you even invested in it to think that your children might have it one day and you would get people in to come and repair it. And somehow, when we had a very big box retailer that had great ambitions about kind of democratizing good design, we switched into this idea that furniture was somehow just, you know, a disposable commodity.
And can I, like, this is something my husband and I talk about every time there's a general cleanup. I just can't get my head around how much there is on the side of the road regularly. And it's like, how is this actually happening? How do people have this much stuff that it keeps appearing every few months? It's bizarre.
And they don't think they need, and yet we've got pockets of our community where they're in dire need of furniture things to, you know, fit up women and families trying to get out of domestic violence situations, refugees, like people in social housing, who would love access to some of those products. So we've just got this major sort of disconnect, I guess. And then what sort of happened as well is, I think, as over the years, like, the furniture's become less and less repairable. So it's not easy actually to hold on to that piece for a long period of time. And then because we offshored our whole manufacturing sector, we don't have kind of people in Australia anymore who can do that repair work, or it's really hard to find them. And so I think this is sort of like, it is very much about going back to the future and kind of having people kind of rethink how they consume things. So that we're not creating these mountains of waste. And in some instances also we're looking at, you know, what does the government need to do to regulate some of this stuff? Like, why is it okay to just put it out on the curbside? Why does the council facilitate that? You know, what are other ways that we could look at dealing with some of that waste? And for us it was very much around looking at, it's a design problem in many instances. So how do you design furniture that can be easily repaired, that's built to last, that doesn't really fit into kind of the faddish sort of fashion side of things? So there's been a lot of, in particular, I feel like the Instagram kind of era almost facilitates that idea that you need to have a house that looks like this, because that's what this influencer has. And And, you know, but in the end, like, I feel as though your home in particular should be something that's a reflection of you. And what is it that actually makes you happy? What's special to you? Like, it might be your daggy grandmother's chair, but because it holds an emotional connection to you, should you just throw it out because you saw some, you know, interior on Instagram that looked a particular way? Or, you know, and I think, like, some things that have been kind of nice to see are these more sort of slightly more eclectic kind of fit outs and things and homes where maybe there are elements of that creeping back in. But yeah, the waste problem is just ginormous. And then we also have a big problem with a lot of issues with the actual input materials for furniture. So they're actually quite bad for you, some of them. So I remember a story of a container, a shipping container that had been repurposed for some quick emergency housing up in the Northern Territory at some point. And they couldn't work out why people who were staying in there kept getting sick, and they kept getting the same sort of symptoms. And then they worked out that a whole lot of furniture had been transported in that container from overseas, and it had really, really high formaldehyde levels in it. And so that formaldehyde was still in that shipping container. So just imagine that in your home or in your workplace. And then you start to kind of see that it's not just a waste problem, it's also like a health problem. You know, and I think there are things that the government should be doing, like in terms of regulation, to start to set stronger standards around that. There's been some work that the Australian Furniture Association's done around PFAS chemicals, which are the forever chemicals. So we have regulations for a lot of those in Australia, but not when it comes to imported products. And we just, yeah, I guess, like, I felt that, you know, we're creating products that go into schools. we need to know what's in those materials and feel confident that we're not doing anything that actually could have a health impact on those kids at some point and would definitely impact their learning as well. So
gosh, you don't even think about that, do you? Like the health impacts, that's shocking to hear about that.
Enjoying the podcast? If you're looking for more inspiration, head to our website, thecauseeffect.com.au, for more resources on how you can start using your business as a force for good. Or buy the For Love and Money book. Every copy sold allows us to protect 1 square metre of rainforest. Help us save 10,000 square metres by 2025.
I just want to, because I want you to share what you're actually doing in response to this problem, but just briefly, can you, like, the scale of that problem, which you put in your action plan, the visual scale, I think you referenced the Sydney Harbour Bridge. Can you share that? I'll tell you, it was that the total amount of furniture thrown out annually by Australian households is more than 4 times the weight of the Sydney Harbour Bridge. Wow.
Yeah, it's crazy, isn't it?
Okay. So, and also that it each family produces about 2.1 tons of waste per person, enough rubbish to fill a 3-bedroom house each year.
Yeah.
Oh,
which is horrifying, isn't it?
Like, it is. So you just need those visual images sometimes, don't you, to really understand, you know, what is the problem that we're dealing with here. So that said, what is Koskela doing to address these problems?
So the shift to circularity is really all about that. So the idea behind circularity is, it really originates at the design phase. So you design products that are built to last, they're high quality, they are something that probably has to have a bit more of a classic kind of design aesthetic to it, and that they're repairable. So it means that if you're designing a sofa, for instance, you know, the standard sort of contemporary model of upholstery for sofas involves glues being applied to the foam or the frame, and staple guns being used. So in order to get that sofa reupholstered, it has to come back to a factory. So it means that you're sitting on the floor for 4 to 6 weeks, or you happen to have a spare sofa around, or in an office, like it's the same issue. So what we've done, and we've just finished the last redesign and testing all of our sofas, and a lot of our all of our upholstered booths come with removable covers now. So that means that a client can just buy the cover. So it does enable you then to have a bit of fun with your interior as well. So you could potentially have two covers, you know, one for winter and one for summer, for instance, or one with a pattern and one without, and you can play around with those. So it doesn't mean that, you know, all the fun has to go out of kind of interior design and things. It's just about thinking about it a bit differently. And that has a massive carbon impact. So, you know, versus buying a whole new sofa, then it means things need to be built so that they're modular. So it's very easy then to either ship out a replacement component or have someone from our install team go to site to repair that item or to refresh it. And it means also that as an originator of products, we have a commitment to actually undertaking that repair. So we either have, you know, partners in each state who can do that work on our behalf and who are trained and who have access to all the right replacement parts, or it's something that the user themselves can actually do. And then the idea, the other sort of element, is to try and keep products in circulation for as long as possible. And so that's both looking at sort of repair options, but it's also looking at things like Rehome, which is our second life model. So we launched that towards the end of last year, and that enables customers to trade in their old pieces with us in return for a store credit, which they can then use to buy something else. And we then undertake to refurbish that piece. We might have to reupholster it or do different things to it, and then to resell that. And the great thing about that is that it enables customers who maybe who love our aesthetics, our values, but don't have the budget to buy our products, to access our products at sort of probably around 30% less than what a new one would cost.
That's great.
Yeah. And then if those products come back to us and they really are not salvageable, then our commitment is to make sure that they go get pulled apart into their components and each of those components is recycled. And what we found with, in particular, a lot the commercial sort of office furniture and even with schools and university work that we do, that even though we had our GECA certification and that had a product stewardship obligation, so that's where there's sort of a requirement on the company that originates the product or sells it to take back that product if the customer doesn't want it, we would never get contacted about products that were ours that the company didn't want anymore. They would automatically go into landfill or somehow end up somewhere else, but we never knew where. And it didn't matter how often we tried to contact our customers and organise maintenance visits and things. Quite often it was really difficult to get the right person within a big corporate who sort of understood what we were offering, because no one else really proactively kind of went out to do maintenance on their products. We sort of felt that actually the best way to deal with that was to never let the end customer own the piece. So they could pay to use the pieces, but they never owned it. And so this was sort of the idea is basically a subscription model. So we started looking at this in around 2018, originally as a product offering for the build to rent sector. So it's very similar. So in that instance, the property asset owner creates a property asset that they hold on to, and their objective is to rent that out to tenants, so in a residential sense. For as long as possible. So they have to build a really high quality product. They've got to offer kind of additional amenity to make it something that tenants really want to be in and to stay in for as long as possible. They actually have to kind of bend over backwards for the tenants. So, and the tenants are allowed to do things like put pictures up and have pets and do all the things that you can do when you own a home. And in Australia, we've got sort of this weird obsession with home ownership that doesn't really exist in other parts of the world. So in many other parts of the world, like in the US, I think 25% of all property assets in the residential sector are held in these kind of structures. So, and it's big US pension funds. So in our instance, some of them have invested in Australia or super funds, which will hopefully create a much better sort of level playing field for renters in Australia. But then what happened sort of post-COVID, I guess, we saw that, and the build-to-rent sector is definitely growing in Australia, and we do see that as being an opportunity further down the track. But post-COVID, what we've seen is a lot of our corporate tenants, initially when everyone came back to work or didn't come back to work because they were so happy working at home, there was kind of a whole lot of navel-gazing and questioning around what the role of the office is and is there a role for it anymore at all or has it gone? And I think what we've seen as time has gone on is that there really is a role for people to come together. Like we are at our heart, you know, sort of biologically driven to create communities and to be with people. And have relationships with people and connections. And so there is sort of a role to play for, you know, the office, as different as that may be from somewhere where you go every single day and work. In some organisations and in some roles that will remain the case. But in most, it's probably some sort of a hybrid workplace. And so these sort of traditional offices don't really work anymore either. Like, you know, we've all got stories from either ourselves or friends who've gone into the office, hey, and nobody's there, and they spend their whole day sitting on their computer on Teams calls, or, you know, five people in a team are there, but another two are working from home. And they, you know, there's no meeting rooms available because everyone else is in them. So how do they actually get together? And we started to develop a whole lot of products to deal with this problem sort of during the COVID years, actually, and post-COVID. And I think there's an opportunity. I think what it's shown, though, is through all of this is that this sort of idea of I'll design it, I'll build it, I'll put all of this effort in. I need to be kind of 99.5% sure that all of this furniture I've just invested in is actually going to work for my workplace for the next 10 years. And, you know, it's not going to change. And I don't think anyone in leadership within an organization believes that the shape of their workforce and how they work won't change within another 10 years.
God, 5 years, 3 years, 2 years.
Yeah, we're seeing like lease terms shrinking. So what, you know, and we already subscribe to a lot of things in an office. So plants, no one owns a plant anymore. Printers, you know, computers. There's air conditioning, lighting that you can all use as a service rather than floor tiles, rather than actually putting it as a capital expense that will then one day end up in landfill. So we're pretty excited about this as an opportunity. We think it's got, and we've been having a lot of conversations with different people within the market. It definitely is a big fundamental reshift, both for the interior designers working on projects, but also things like leasing agents and building owners and then the end clients. But yeah, we think that there's a huge amount of appeal in a high interest rate, kind of higher inflation environment where it's not as easy to access capital or it's more expensive to do it. So why invest capital in furniture when you could invest it in your business? To also the fact that a lot of our big corporates will be subject to the compulsory carbon emissions reporting from this year onwards. So they need to be looking at all different ways that they can reduce their carbon footprint. And this is another really good way for them to do that.
I love it. I love it. It's brilliant. And what really stands out for me here is your leadership. Koskela's leadership. I mean, you are the first Australian B Corp certified furniture business. So you are obviously leading the way there because, you know, to actually get that certification is not an easy thing to achieve. But this, you know, you've described the problem that no matter what you tried to do, having, you know, created the design solutions, you still weren't getting the traction that you needed. And it seems like the evolution of how you solve that problem.
Yeah.
And that's leadership, right? And it drives innovation. And I am a firm believer that social purpose, you know, that drive towards how can we solve, you know, these problems in society is the single biggest driver of innovation in the world. I've got guest after guest on this podcast and example after example that I share that actually evidences that.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. If I think about all of the big kind of innovations, maybe not Uber, but I don't know, maybe at their heart they kind of had a purpose initially. I don't know.
In the beginning, they were. Yeah. It was very much about solving a problem, and the problem was the state of the taxi industry at the time. Yeah. So it was about improving it. It's changed.
Yeah,
but nevertheless, that's where it started.
Yeah.
And it makes sense because you know my background is marketing, and I owned an agency for nearly 20 years. I was on the agency side, and the number of client briefs I sat in on with big corporates where, you know, they needed to do product innovation and they do all these research groups and try to find something, but so often it was manufactured innovation. Totally. Do you know what I mean? You manufacture the problem.
Absolutely.
But these are real problems that need solving, and they need solving urgently, and that's exactly what you're doing. I saw on LinkedIn that this subscription model idea, recently won the Innovation Pitch Fest Award at Circularity 2023 in Melbourne. Congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah, that was a really great honour and a really great opportunity to kind of test the idea and put it out there and see what sort of reaction we got at a forum where people kind of already knew what Circularity was about. It was really fantastic endorsement of the idea.
And so it's a concept. I know you've said you've already put time and effort and resources into it. When are you hoping to bring it to market?
We're actively working with a range of different clients. So our goal is really just to get the first one or two customers to trial the idea. We've secured loan funding to underpin the first couple of transactions. We've got some investment. We've done a lot of the hard work and the thinking. We've done all the product kind of innovation and things. And we're in, you know, pretty good, quite solid discussions with a few different corporates and a couple of schools and unis as well who are looking at it. So it's pretty exciting.
That's incredibly exciting. And I imagine you're going to get takers. I mean, with corporates, especially with their ESG requirements, I mean, it sounds to me like this is the right product at the right time for the need.
Yeah, yeah, I agree.
Oh, fantastic. Congratulations. So this podcast is called For Love and Money. We explore purpose, which we've thoroughly done here today with what you're doing. I'd like to touch on the profitability side, the money side. Like you've been going for 24 years, so that speaks volumes.
Yes, it does. We're still going, which is pretty fantastic. So I think, I don't know, one thing I think is kind of interesting when you're a purpose-driven organisation is getting that balance right and kind of getting the team to sort of understand that the two have to go hand in hand. And because we talk about profit doesn't mean we care any less about our impact. And so, you know, sort of realizing that you can't do all the impact work if you're not profitable. So And I think there are still things that we could do better in terms of sort of looking at ways that you can link those two ambitions more closely and filter that through the whole organisation. But yeah, it's been like, you know, I kind of can't believe we've been doing this for as long as we have.
Because time has flown.
Well, we just, you know, there's always the next new kind of innovation or change that we're looking at impacting. So we're not the kind of company that sits still, and I'm certainly not motivated by doing the same thing over and over again and just getting better and better at it, which is good and bad. I think it's good to have some people within a company who love that. And I think that is sort of the magic. If you can, within sort of the leadership team of the organization, if, you know, often it's the founder that is the kind of impact-driven person, but you need to kind of recognize that you also need someone alongside who has that execution kind of ability and is the one that kind of can translate the purpose and the profit and make sure that those two are working hand in hand. And I think sometimes that can get lost a little bit.
That balance is crucial, isn't it? Yeah. I've heard it described as if purpose is actually, it was described to me as purpose is the destination and profit is the fuel. Yeah. But I like to think of it as purpose is the journey.
Yeah, yeah, it's
and
true.
Profit is the fuel that makes that journey possible.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, yeah.
And I think that gives you the clarity about the relationship between the two. And, you know, the bigger your impact goals, the more profitable you need to be.
Yeah. Yeah, it's so true.
Yeah. Yeah.
So and impact you can
have. Yeah, absolutely. You know, if you're serious about scaling your impact, which clearly you guys are, you know, you've demonstrated that in droves, then you have to be profitable. So you know, the two are intrinsically interlinked. So Sasha, it's 2024.
Yep.
Got 3 years to your 2027 target date for your circularity action plan. That takes you to the end of 2027.
Yeah.
And then it's only another 3 years to 2030, which is the target date for the UN Sustainable Development Goals. What's your, obviously you're pretty clear on what you want to achieve by 2027. In your greatest dreams, what's your vision for what Koskoles could achieve by 2030?
Ooh, that is a tough one. Definitely in terms of the subscription model, like I'd like to see that as being almost the norm. So it's either a reuse or a subscription model that's being used in all of our commercial sort of offerings. And that we'd be getting very close to our sort of ultimate ambition of achieving kind of absolute zero emissions. So how could you do that within a company like ours? You know, could we have all electric or renewable powered transport options available? Yeah, could we see our products in leading sort of corporates, you know, potentially even outside of Australia? So if our subscription model was really a success, would it be possible to have locally manufactured to a particular market products, but they're all Australian designed and that are being used kind of all around the world or in different parts of it? That would be pretty cool. And, you know, maybe you could get to a point where you almost had enough products that you've manufactured and that are just constantly being circulated that you're not really producing much new product anymore at all.
Brilliant. And if you achieve that, then another opportunity is that Koskoles becomes, you know, an inspiration and a story that inspires the industry.
Yeah. And that's sort of, you know, we believe that I guess we're sort of in a unique position at the moment in terms of our ability to do this, that we're motivated to do it. We're We are originators of our own products, so we can do all of the things that you, to do a subscription model successfully, you really need to have differently designed products, particularly in a country as vast as Australia. Otherwise, you'll lose all your profitability in transport. And then I think we're locally manufactured, so we have all that knowledge here. We've got local teams, so we can do all that in-store work and things. But my sort of goal and the reason why we went public with our circularity action plan was to really share all of our learnings, our wins, our failures, and provide a blueprint ultimately for other people within the industry to follow.
I love it. And I'm going to link your contact details, but specifically your circularity action plan, because I think it is a blueprint for inspiration, you know, not just within this industry, but others as well. So congratulations on what you've achieved to date. It's amazing. And, you know, best wishes for the next stage of your journey and launching this subscription product. I can't wait to see and hear about it and hopefully share some of the stories of its success in the future. So, Sasha, thank you so much for joining us. I will hand over to you to close us out with any last words.
I guess my last words really, and thank you so much, Carolyn, for the conversation. It's been, I don't often take time to reflect, I guess, and it's quite good sometimes to do that. But I guess really I want to just try and get people to think about what you can do, what your business can do, whether it's big or small. You know, small businesses in Australia are the lion's share of businesses. Big businesses should be well on their journey in terms of carbon reductions. But it's really up to every one of us and every single business in Australia to play their part. And I hope to see more and more businesses thinking about this sort of thing and thinking about what their obligation is, I guess, to leave the planet a better place than when they found it.
Wise words. Thank you, Sasha.
All right. Thanks, Carolyn.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the For Love and Money podcast. If you'd like to take a deeper dive into the purpose movement, visit us at thecauseeffect.com.au. And remember, doing good is good for business. So if you're not doing good, then what are you doing?